This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Professor Bruce Falk. Bruce, what department are you with?
My home department is the Department of Geology, but I also have an appointment in microbiology and the Institute for Genomics Biology.
Well, we'll get into some of that in a minute, but we're going to be talking today about creation and evolution and how a person of faith can be a scientist and also believe in a God, questions like that. What do you tell your kids? You have three children, as I remember, an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old and what, a 5?
Three.
What do you tell your 8-year-old when, is that a girl?
Mm-hmm.
When she asks questions
mm-hmm.
about where do we come from?
Well, it's always good to be constantly humbled by your children. And my wife and I, Anne, we try to approach it from a very open atmosphere of kind of critical free thought. We do believe in the idea of you set up the framework in which the kids can work. And so we try to have open discussions. And we are happy to bring things to the point we know for sure and then we discuss beyond that to the point we don't know. And
now, in terms of things you know for sure, as a scientist, particularly somebody who deals with genetics and microbiology and things like that, of course, evolution is something you just assume.
Yeah, it's one of those basic working principles. We have an incredible wealth of evidence to show that life has changed consistently throughout the history of the Earth, and now we presume on other planets as well. And the important thing is that we have a body of evidence that is basically very solid and needs to be explained. And that's kind of where we begin with it.
And so if you begin by assuming that evolutionary change takes place, where do people come in that for you who also attend a Methodist church regularly?
Right. Well, you know, the two go hand in hand. I actually go back to Darwin himself, who was a deeply religious person and was very well grounded in Anglican theology and science. And if you look at some of his writings, he has the same kind of complete synthesis, complementary approaches to science and faith. And the kind of basic idea for myself is that we are given these gifts of observation and intuitive reasoning and an obligation to apply these to the best of our ability. And so we have, again, this wealth of information that we live in on the earth all the time that is indicating that there's been this long progressive change in life and what life is composed of. And so the two actually are very complementary. To me, a spiritual life, it drives the idea of the thirst for knowledge and the inquisitive open mind to see and look at what's around you. I think that all of us in our everyday life, everyone's life is an evolutionary pathway, and things constantly change, at least they do for me, at each stage of my life. And it's a direct application of that from a daily basis to a career basis, looking at these changes through time.
Now, when your eight-year-old says, "Daddy, I heard somewhere that people came from monkeys," did we?
Well, absolutely. We know that there's a very robust history of fossilized bones that were derived from early hominids going from apes. We know that some of the record is not totally complete, but overall there's a sequence of events that makes both logical and intuitive sense. And so when they ask me those questions, we usually pull out either something off the internet, or we go to National Geographic, or we go to the most recent science. We go to the literature, just like we do at the university, mm-hmm. and look to see what the evidence, how it looks at the moment.
And what do you say when she comes to you, your daughter says, "My Sunday school teacher says that God made us"?
Well, I respond to her that, yes, there is a God that exists. It's not a God that's, in my mind, anthropomorphic at all. It's not a human-characterized God, but it's a greater force that's part of everything. And that force has been very active the whole change and evolution of life as we have seen it on this planet change through time. So I try to respond by saying that there's a real synergy between the concept of God and the idea that, yes, then life has changed and we've seen how it operates around us.
Let me explain to listeners that although this program, Keeping the Faith, is almost always a live call-in program, it happens today that we've had to pre-record this program because of travel schedules for me and our guest today. And there will be opportunities to discuss this topic with callers at a later time. But for today, we will not be inviting calls because this is a pre-recorded program. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and we're very happy today to have Professor Bruce Fauk. And let me make sure I pronounce your last name correctly. It's spelled F-O-U-K-E. How do you say it?
It's an impossible Dutch name, right? So, actually, in Holland, it's a first name.
Oh,
and in Holland, they pronounce it Foka. And for some reason, when my ancestors came over and settled here in the States, they changed it to Fauk.
So, Fauk. Bruce Fauk.
And it has a whole series of interesting manifestations from there.
And Bruce, tell our listeners a little bit about your scientific background. Where did you get your training?
Mm-hmm. Well, my real training with science actually started at home. My father's a Methodist minister, but at the same time, we also they always opened up our minds as children to science and wilderness and nature. And so my training in science really began there. Mm-hmm. My parents were quite proactive with that. And then I went to the Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois for my undergraduate. Then I went from there to the University of Iowa and did a master's. And then I went from there to the University of Chicago, did a second master's. And that one was in real hardcore paleobiology and evolutionary studies. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the State University of New York at Stony Brook to complete my PhD. And then, of course, the tortuous pathway of academics continued. And so I did a 3-year postdoc position in Amsterdam. We were at the Free University in Amsterdam, and we worked on rocks and sea level changes, actually, in coral reefs all over the world, including Africa and throughout Asia and throughout Europe and various places in North America.
Did you speak the Dutch language from home?
No, we didn't have any Dutch training. And my wife and I, when we got there, we put in some concerted effort where we could function at least. So, because it's pretty easy, they speak a pretty good brand of English there, right? Mm-hmm. And then I went from Amsterdam to Berkeley, and the Berkeley project got even more interesting. I worked with Walter Alvarez on the meteorite that killed the dinosaurs, or at least was associated with the killing of the dinosaurs. And then I went from there to NASA and worked with NASA on looking at the famous Martian meteorite and the potentials for evidence of bacterial life on Mars. And then things evolved to where I could accept a faculty position here at Illinois. So.
And you mentioned the three different sort of parts of the university that where you work. How are they combined?
Well, the wave of the future, and this is actually quite well stated on brochures and websites of things like the National Science Foundation, but the wave of the future is the integration at all scales and all time frames of basically every parameter of the natural environment that we understand in order to make accurate predictions of, say, climatic change through time, to make accurate interpretations of the history of life and evolution, to understand many of the parameters of our natural world. We have to integrate everything from geology to chemistry to physics to microbiology. There has to be this really integrative, holistic approach. And again, the important thing is to do these on multiple time frames, going from microseconds to billions of years, to multiple spatial frameworks, going from fractions of a micron all the way up to thousands of kilometers. And so the integrative approach we need to have to do that is requiring that we break down all the walls of kind of standard approaches to doing natural sciences. And so that's a long way of saying that when I arrived here in Illinois, I was kind of a full-fledged geologist who'd worked on coral reefs but integrated out and did some other types of work. And then when I got here, I was fortunate enough to meet up with Carl Woese and Abigail Saliers, and they brought me into the world of molecular microbiology. And so my current positions reflect this integration of that. And the new Institute for Genomics Biology is a crucible in which this integrative science that's going to guide the future is being forged. So it's kind of the perfect mix. And we have one of the research themes there we call biocomplexity in the environment.
Now, when you combine these various types of science, you have different worldviews. You have different ways of thinking when you're in biology than when you're in geology, I would think. How does that stretch your mind?
The way I describe it is that if you were to be rock climbing, an easy day would be a vertical cliff face. And most of my days, the cliff face is bending over on top of you over what we call the angle of repose, and you're hanging by your fingernails. So, but it's a constant challenge. You have to be in a mind frame that, yes, you have a base of knowledge from which you're working, but the ability to integrate fully into these areas of physics and chemistry and what have you requires colleagueship. And requires the open mind of saying, this is what I do know, this is what I don't know, and let's work together to find out how they fit together.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a time when to be a practicing scientist at a major research university, it would be a great disadvantage if people found out you had any religious inclinations. Yeah. Is that no longer true?
Well, there's definitely barriers to be crossed in that regard. There's a couple things running. You know, I get to carry the what I consider to be something I'm very proud of, but it ends up being a stigma oftentimes, is that I'm a preacher's kid.
Sure.
And so that kind of starts the process, and then either I get ostracized or accepted at some level or something in between. And then when you're in the workforce, especially when you study things like evolution how these mechanisms actually work, then there's a real resistance to even really discuss it with most people. And so it's kind of funny. I guess I end up flying under the radar for most of these things. I get to do my work, and I'm happy to discuss it, but I don't bring it into the workplace. I'm not interested, or I don't see a value in having a spiritual part of your life be expressed via proselytizing and recruiting. And that's not, teaching by example across the board is what I'm interested in. So, but there's always that barrier. And there are groups of people where I'll never be able to connect to them because they put me in a pigeonhole.
Sure. And I might just mention, in along the line of full transparency, that I'm married to a scientist, a microbiologist, and that Bruce and I first had some good conversations about some of these issues at Woods Hole, at lunch tables filled with scientists, several of whom were interested in also some questions of religion, of ethics, of values, of faith, of theology. And in fact, I played a little joke on Bruce at Woods Hole when he was giving one of his early lectures, and I sat on the front row, and when he announced his topic, I said, "Geology. I thought you said theology," and left, and got a good laugh from the scientists there.
But I'll never forget that moment. That was superb.
But I knew you would, because of the conversations we'd had at lunch, that you'd find that amusing, and others might too. But to get back to the subject at hand, talking about evolution and science of and ways it bumps up against other ways of thinking in terms of religion. Of course, Hindus don't have the problem because in Hinduism there are many different creation stories and they're mutually contradictory, and that doesn't bother Hindus. And there can be a Hindu scientist who can do hard science and still have this way of practicing their faith and thinking, and there's no conflict. But with the monotheistic religions, with Islam, with Judaism, with Christianity, you have these early sagas, these legends, these stories about God creating the world in certain ways. And for many years, there were people who interpreted those literally. Mm-hmm. Some still do. I don't. Mm-hmm. But how do you, as a scientist, deal with people who come to you and say things where they're presuming a literal interpretation of some of those stories.
Well, that's the key point, Steve, is that it's not, again, I don't there's not a literal interpretation at all. I see that we have a responsibility, and this is across the board, whether it comes to religion or politics or history of humanity or whatever you're looking at. We have a responsibility to carefully read and think through and logically construct a working paradigm for ourselves, both in terms of your spiritual life and your intellectual life, and then the mechanics of how you express your life. So the literal aspect is completely off the board. And I see, you know, we know the history of the Bible is one that it's a uniquely revised edition in terms of so many levels of interpretation and translation and use in various ways, both good and bad. So leaving the literal aspects off the table then allows you to have this kind of just very open, interactive interaction with, you know, the Quran or with the Bible or with the Bhagavad Gita or with whichever text you're working. And I kind of see it as we have a responsibility to learn from this incredibly rich tradition of human civilization and the thought processes. You know, I mean, if you look at it in many ways, where we are as human beings today, I know many people think that we're so advanced. But, you know, I've worked in ancient Rome, one of my projects, I oftentimes think when we're in the Colosseum or other buildings the same struggles, the people trying to find meaning and happiness and trying to have a full life and have a life of both, you know, tangible and spiritual meaning, the same struggles are going on. We could probably pull someone out from the streets of Rome 2,000 years ago, and other than the technology drape, probably a very similar series of events, you know. So so that being said, there's this long-term consistency, and we have a responsibility to understand that context. And I think that's what this spiritual addition to my life is so important. It gives my life in terms of my family and my personal side, but also my work, it gives it a contextual framework that has meaning for me. So.
What are the conflicts?
Oh, you know, I honestly... The way I see things, the only conflict is when you adopt some form of a literal interpretation of either anything you're working on, really. And so as soon as you drop that literal interpretation, I honestly don't have huge conflicts. You know, I mean, there's issues like, how do you execute and perform your everyday life? How do your actions reflect how do your deeds reflect your thoughts?
And ethics are hard for everybody.
And ethics are hard for everybody. And so, and there are guidelines that I don't care where you're from or what you do. there are guidelines of living that are pretty consistent. And that's another reason I enjoy working around the world so much, is that you get to live and breathe and actually immerse yourself in these wildly different environments. And I think environment has a huge impact, obviously, on how people conceptualize reality.
There have been some news stories in recent decades that have talked about the problems of scientists who lie, who fudge the data, who are so pressured to produce, who have to, you know, get tenure, who have to get out the next book, get the next grant. How does your spiritual training, your religious background, does that help in any way, or does it get in the way?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I mean, again, the
science is dog eat dog.
Absolutely. Well, you know, being consistent, consistently honest, consistently having the well-being of others around you in your circumstance as well as yourself, that kind of consistency, that's rooted in honesty. And whenever honesty is broached or betrayed, no matter what the circumstance, it's going to result in bad circumstances. Mm-hmm. And so it's very unfortunate that people, I think, you know, the pressures are immense. And whether it's in science or, you know, we look at Iraq and lying about, you know, the presence of these weapons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, It's unacceptable across the board, no matter where it stands. And then the results are usually catastrophic at some level.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's really unfortunate because science is a realm. One of the things I enjoy about it so much is that there is this crisp, clean scientific method. And regardless of interpretation, and that's always diffuse and what have you, but there's this logical progression of how to approach a problem, extract and observe data at all levels, and then put it together with some kind of a working interpretation, a hypothesis that makes sense,
mm-hmm.
with the willingness to know that that could be turned on its head 180 degrees within the next few microseconds, depending on what new evidence emerges, right? So there's a crispness and there's a consistency about the scientific method that's rooted in a very kind of deep honesty, I think, of how mm-hmm. we approach things.
What are some of the insights that you've gained from your religious tradition that help you as you think about what creation is, what the natural world is, how it began? Are there any things in those early Jewish and Christian sagas that are helpful to you?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, you know, I've tried to read the basic texts and especially in the Judeo-Christian format. You know, for me, it boils down to really the idea that there are many things and forces and concepts that we simply can't explain or understand fully. And so if you are willing to come to that point of departure, then at least in my mind, there are all the fundamentals we really don't understand, and I feel that we never will understand.
Like what?
What exactly was that essence of the first genesis of life in the form of a microorganism. And we can understand some of the mechanics of it. Again, some of the people on this campus have made incredible advances in that regard. And the mechanics of it we're learning more and more about. But, you know, some of these ideas of what was that initial onset, that initial essence of when life was operating, I personally don't know if we're ever going to have an answer to that, and I don't think mm-hmm. we need that answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to understand the basic context of, you know, the formation of the first life, or the synthesis of the first life, and how that mechanically came about. But there's going to be an aspect of it that we just don't know,
mm-hmm.
and I feel very comfortable living in the realm of not knowing. I, again, with my integrative research, I try to do. I probably spend 50% of my day in an environment of saying, I don't know, but I want to learn. What do we know about it?
And now, some of your projects have really captured the imagination of folks all around. You've been interviewed by NPR nationally a couple times. Tell us a little bit about some of the projects that have forced you to integrate some of these thoughts, mm-hmm. not only within physics and chemistry mm-hmm. and biology, but also religion.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I defer to two things before I answer that. One
sure.
is that my basic approach to everything I do is I'm very thankful for these opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I feel that these opportunities, good luck is the intersection of preparation of opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that my life has been exceptionally fortunate. And a big part of that is because of the ebb and flow of this greater spiritual force that I think is present, but also just the unique opportunity to be with specific individual people who have touched my life very deeply on both personal and professional realms. So I wanted to say that it's kind of my basic template as to how to answer that question.
And the notion of thankfulness or gratitude does get supported from most religious traditions.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. And I guess the humility, I'm very keyed into at how, you know, we can look at life as though we are entitled to much. And I think that that's one of the problems with modern day society is there's a huge entitlement issue going on.
Sure.
I look at it this way, and I guess part of this is I spent a lot of time working in Russia, and there are some real struggles in working there. We were in tents. We lived out of jeeps. We lived on the steppes of Russia, you know, the campfires, the vodka, the long-term suffering involved with that kind of thing.
Mm.
And one of the things we came up with in the evenings around the fire, and it's pretty telling, I think, is that because I became such close friends with my Russian colleagues, so here we are in the middle of nowhere and trying to understand why we got along so well.
Mm.
And the basic premise was that we came up with the following, and that is that it seems like in Russia there's a concept that if you work really hard, life is going to be full of difficulties, and no matter what you do, it's going to be difficult. Yeah. And really, the only time you really get a break in a lot of circumstances, and I'm paraphrasing from what my friends have come up with, but the idea is that life is suffering, life is difficult, but when you get to a certain point, maybe you'll have the good fortune to have someone step in and help you, like a boss or a professor or something. And then we came up with the alternative, the Western view. The Western view is that life is really pretty good. If you work really hard, you deserve to have good things happen. And really, the only time that things will get screwed up is when someone steps in to destroy it, like your professor or your boss or something like that. So, and actually, the end result of many, many evenings of discussion of this is that the Russian philosophy might be much more positive than the
starts off pessimistic, but ends up right.
So in that regard, but I've been very fortunate, and I owe so much of the successes I've had to the interactions of these very significant people. Who I've had.
What were you working on in Russia?
We were reconstructing the timing, rate, and magnitude of sea level change that took place approximately 92 million years ago. And the Russian craton, the middle of the Russian countryside there, the middle of the continent, acted as a freeboard. And so every time that sea level rose or fell due to glacial activity, then you'd have the sea level would rush all the way up to Moscow and then rush all the way back. It's kind of like here in the Midwest. During the Ordovician time period, which a lot of rocks in Illinois are that age, there were times when Minneapolis was the beach, and we were underwater here, say, a few hundred meters.
One of the things that's most frustrating to me as someone trained in religion and Christian theology is in talking to scientists who have a wonderful, expansive education in science, in history, in many of the liberal arts as well, certainly mathematics, but who are totally ignorant in religion. And so when they say something like 92 million years ago, I sit there, I often think that they're looking at me thinking that I believe the world was created in 5005 BC, which...
I know better than that. So.
But people have such a not only a narrow view, but an ignorant view of what religious people of today usually think. And I don't know why.
Well, there's a stigma. It's almost gotten to the point now where if you say that you have a religious spiritual life and that you're active in a community congregation, that many people you say that to will pigeonhole you into the most extreme literalist, fundamentalist approach to anything you do.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just know that's not accurate. And in fact, some of the most wise and gentle and beautiful and wonderful people you could ever meet, open-minded, accomplished, they're all part of these different congregations throughout our community. And again, it's just this unfortunate thing of whenever you pigeonhole people and put them in some kind of category and then shove them away, you're missing out on the whole experience of interacting with other people.
And one of the things that continues to frustrate me on this campus here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign is there's still not a full Department of Religion. It's a religious studies program. It's this little minor thing, though. We'll allow it over here on the side.
Right.
And all those people have PhDs from wonderful institutions.
Yep.
Other Big Ten schools have departments of religion. All of the major research universities in this country and many abroad have departments of religion.
Right.
We have departments of leisure studies. You know, you can get a PhD in leisure studies at this university. You can study volleyball, but you can't study religion.
It's
at a PhD level. It's just absurd.
And you know, that's so out of step for basically how this school works. You know, because it's so comprehensive, it's so broad, it's so welcoming to new ideas, and that is a strange hole.
Yeah, it is. And as a result, I think often people have this big gap in their in their knowledge of Christianity and Judaism and Islam and things. In you know, billions of people are following these faiths, and we somehow still have this resistance to trying to understand that, whether we believe it or not.
Right,
you know?
right. No, it's incredible, and but no, you know, the way again, all this gets expressed is again we teach through our deeds and actions, and you know this I try to look, I think. You know, the way I describe my work is, you know, I work on coral reefs. I work on hot springs in Yellowstone. I work on archaeology projects in Rome. I get to work on meteorite impacts. And you tell people that, and it sounds wild, right? But the reason it works for me in terms of such a broad expanse of things is that I have a thread. And the thread I need for my science work is I need to have water in its chemistry. I need to have minerals that precipitate from the water. And I need to have bacteria or other microorganisms that live in that water. So and it, if you have those things fulfilled, then everything else makes sense. And it's a very comprehensive package.
Now, why ancient Rome?
Well, I had the good fortune, Eric Hostetter is a professor here. And we were put into touch by mutual friends. Another part of being part of the strength of our community here and the ability to interact is phenomenal. And Eric and I met through some mutual friends and started talking, and we forged a project to look at the timing of the last flow of water in the aqueducts of Rome. But it was the same techniques we use on the reefs. It was the same techniques we use in Yellowstone. It was just downloading the same toolkit in a different context.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Professor Bruce Fauke of the University of Illinois, F-O-U-K-E, a hard-pronounced Dutch name he's told me a couple times. And let me explain to listeners that although typically this program is live and listeners may call in with questions or comments, today because of our schedule, we needed to pre-record this program. So I want to thank our guest for making a special effort to come in during the week and record this for broadcast on Sunday. We will be back to our usual format next week. We're talking with Bruce about issues of evolution, of creation, and religion. He is the son of a Methodist minister and an active member of a Christian congregation here in Champaign-Urbana. He is a graduate of Bradley University and has masters from the University of Iowa and University of Chicago, and a PhD from the State University of New York in Stony Brook, did postdoc work in Amsterdam, and then was at Berkeley before coming to the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Tell us a little bit about your work with these meteorites and things from outer space and Mars.
Well, again, you know, the thread of consistency is where it works, right? So what happened was that when I was in my PhD work focused on the formation of limestones that were created by the fossilized skeletons of corals. And so I worked in the southernmost Caribbean on the islands of Aruba, Bonaire, and Curacao. And that was my PhD work. And then I went to Holland to look at the same kind of history of how coral reefs grew and died and the relationship to relative sea level change. But I went back deep in time. And so the ones in Aruba, Bonaire, Curacao are on the order of about, they go from modern day to about 16 million years old. And then when I did my postdoc in Europe, I looked at rocks and coral reefs that were actually formed in Africa and then stuck to Europe during plate tectonics and a rifting event that happened. And it brought me back in time, deep time, back to about 92 million all the way back to 350 million years. And I worked on these ancient reefs. And then what happened was that I got in contact with Walter Alvarez at University of California, Berkeley. And of course, he and his father are the two that came up with the evidence for a major meteor impact at the time of the demise of the dinosaurs at the Cretaceous Tertiary boundary about 65 million years ago. And so I approached Walter, and the pitch there was, well, I'd spent several years of my career figuring out how reefs are formed. How about looking at how reefs are destroyed at the moment that a meteor hits them? And so the meteor hit the tip of the Yucatan Peninsula. It's a very huge accumulation of coral reef sediments. And so that was the linkage there. Instead of forming reefs, destroy them and find out things like, well, just how toxic was the atmosphere that the dinosaurs and other organisms would have had to deal with? And the way you do that is you look at what was hit, what was vaporized, and how it was put into the atmosphere. And then the next logical step from that, it turned out, I could never have planned this, right? It was just something that happened, but the NASA got
now, as a Presbyterian, I'd say it's providential.
It's providential. There we go. NASA approached me and said, you ever thought about using that same toolkit and looking for life on other planets? So I had a little bit of a meteor background, a little bit of changing life on planet Earth background, and then some of the tools of water, mineral precipitation, and now since I got to Illinois, bacteria and archaeal microbes. So,
There was a cartoon in the New Yorker a few issues back where it had these two slimy creatures crawling across the desert, I suppose, and one was saying to the other, "We're slugs. We don't have creation myths." Why do humans have creation myths? Let me ask you the tough question. I mean, do people just make these up?
I think that a lot of the details and specifics of creation myths from around the world, a lot of it, I think, is driven by the dynamics of the environment in which they live. Mm-hmm. And whether they live on the gigantic, say, sand sheets of the world's great deserts, whether they live deep in a rainforest that's thick and lush, and they can see, you know, on a regular basis 5 feet in front of them instead of, you know, several hundreds of miles in front of them, what if water is available on a regular basis, how harsh the environment is, what's the threat of having other human beings come in and take all that you have, including your life. All these things, I think, all come together to drive the need for some level of understanding, and also drives the specifics of what that understanding is. It's not easy to dwell in a realm where you consistently are trying to say to yourself, I know a little bit, but it's not much. Mm-hmm. And there's an immense amount of truth there that needs to be found. And therefore, I want to put myself in the situation of trying to absorb, learn, and track truth as much as possible. But you have to constantly be ultra humble and ultra able to say, I know very little.
What about contradiction? Is that possible in science, or is that impossible?
Certainly. I mean, you know, we have multiple working hypotheses, which we have to constantly test multiple venues for finding the truth in a scientific question. And it's often, my experience is that it's not till after a lot of hard work that you can rule out one or two of these other lines of hypothesis. So you oftentimes have these running parallel pathways of contradiction that need to be assessed and tested. And so I don't see, you know, again, it's lock and step with what I see as the religious experience. And but then, you know, the point of departure is being deciding I'm going to latch into one form, one version of the answer to this testable hypothesis, mm-hmm. or I'm just going to continue testing and developing hypotheses.
Ah, okay.
And so I see that's the departure for the religious part.
Now, you've said earlier in the program that the way that you kind of conceptualize a divine being, a divine force, a divine spirit, God, is somehow a greater spiritual force. Does that have any personal dimensions for you? As in the Christian tradition, Christians have seen Jesus as somehow showing us something important about God very clearly. Mm-hmm. Is that important to you as a scientist?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in terms of trying to make this the synthesis mix in answer to your question, you know, what you just described is, again, as the moment you take the literal template off the table, then all these things have tremendous personal spiritual meaning. Like, as an example, we're coming up on my most revered, personally, precious religious event of the year, which is Easter. Hmm. And the whole idea that, death is not the end. Hmm. Death is the next step in the progression. Hmm. And we don't know what that next step is exactly, but we know that there is a continuum, and that in many ways it's very important to define your life and how you live it by your concept of what your death is, and it fundamentally changes how you go about doing things. And I see that when I say the greater good, I see all of us, every entity on this planet is part of this greater force. And there's things I've experienced in the jungles of South America, on the reefs of Papua New Guinea, on the hiking the high Triassic in the Alps of Italy. There's just been experience that I've had in terms of sensing, having an awareness of nature and my presence in it and what the meaning of my life is that cannot be explained by anything that I have experience with.
Well, let me push a little bit on that, Bruce. As a scientist, I happen to be a psychology undergraduate. I would say Why isn't that just psychologically perfectly explainable for very naturalistic terms? Mm-hmm. I mean, it might have been something you had for breakfast. It might have been a dream. It might be you're trying to please your father, mm-hmm. who was mm-hmm. a minister. Mm-hmm. Why bring in the religious thing at all, the spiritual aspect?
Right. And well, I guess that's where the characteristic leap of faith comes in, is that I realize you have to come to some point where you say there are things that I don't understand, but I know that they have real existence and meaning, and therefore I'm going to continue along some pathway that will pursue that meaning, mm-hmm. Knowing that a final answer probably will never emerge mm-hmm. in terms of being definitive. And so there's just that's where I come to the point where I know in my the essence of who I am as a person, that there are things that simply cannot be explained.
And now, in science, reproducibility is just basic. I mean, you have to be able to reproduce these experiments. Mm-hmm. Other scientists have to agree with what you've come up with. They have to look at your data. Can there be miracle?
Well, you know, I guess my basic approach to that, again, is that I think that all things, in the end, are possible. I'm very skeptic whenever anything is presented as definitive. So usually miracles are very well-defined, definitive moment events in time and space in general, in terms of either someone, you know, recovering from, say, an accident or an illness or some kind of a spot event. I kind of see the entirety of life as a miracle. You know, the fact that from an energetics, chemical, energy flow standpoint, in terms of what we measure as scientists in the natural environment, life is one way to define it. It's the existence of energy in an environment where that energy wouldn't naturally occur. Mm. And so I see the very existence of life itself as being a good example of that.
We've talked about creation and evolution and your, you know, firm belief that evolutionary ways of thinking are very productive for scientists, very helpful and sort of a basis for you. What about the end? What about not the beginning of life and creation, but you've also studied the destruction of the dinosaurs, possibly with the meteorite affecting this natural system.
Mm-hmm.
If you left faith out as a scientist looking at the natural world, is it mainly grim? And I mean, it's filled with death. It's filled with random acts of cruelty,
right.
as
right.
well as beauty.
Right. Well, you know, again, that's where this we talked a little earlier about the idea of the complexity of life and all its interactions with the environment on all kinds of spatial and time frameworks. And so if you, from a scientific point of view, look at the individual atoms that are making up organisms, us, what have you, it's recycling to the extreme, right? Everything is just, even from the original Big Bang and the original synthesis of the first elements to the stage where we're at now, where these elements are organized in these different patterns and ways, it's the ultimate example of recycling. And so, because you know, if you take any one of the elements that are within us, it has a long history of existence, be it in space, be it on this planet, be it in other organisms. So I have this very, I believe very deeply in many of the basic understandings of Christianity. I also think that some of the Eastern thoughts are just so critical, like this idea that the essence of our life is like a drop of water from the ocean, mm-hmm. where the water hits the shore. Our individuality becomes that moment of the droplet flying through the air after it breaks on the shore, and that's our current pathway. And then the water falls back in the sea and reintegrates. And that's one of the things I think about a lot, mm-hmm. is that during this recycling process of our lives, what level is the reintegration at? Do we maintain this essence of our individual soul, or does that soul become somehow blended with the collective soul? And I don't have any answers for these, but I like to think about them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Or even, you know, the Plato and Aristotle arguments, and, you know, we're still right there. we're still right there. Is the soul, the spirit, different from the somatic, the body, or is there a union on a level that means that they're inextricable from each other, and then therefore there's no continuance after death? I just from my experience of life, there is continuity. There is a continuum beyond death, and what it is, I don't know. But I do know that it's part of this overall consistent force that flows through and in everything. So
we're getting toward the end of this program, and there's still a couple of very big questions I hope to spring on you before you leave us. But let me reintroduce our guest. Professor Bruce Fowke is at the University of Illinois and has studied microbiology and geology and physics and things like that. Has a PhD from State University of New York in Stony Brook, and has been at Berkeley and in Europe as in postdoc work. And we're very happy to have him here today, talking mainly about creation and evolution in relation to also being a person of faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. And for our regular listeners, I'm sorry that we weren't able to include call-ins for this program. We will go back to that more typical format next week. But in order to have this particular guest, we needed to pre-record the program. So we're delighted to have Bruce with us. Bruce, you brought up things you've learned and appreciated from some of the Eastern religious faiths, Buddhism and others. How do you choose to be a practicing Christian and still be open to other philosophies, other religious traditions?
Right. Well, you know, I go back to one of the writings of Gandhi that I wrote is I can't remember the exact. I'm paraphrasing.
That you read.
That he wrote. That I read. And that he said that you know, he's speaking to some Christians, and he said that I probably love and understand more about Christ than you as a Christian do. Mm. And I kind of that made a very big impact on me. I think I owe my openness or my approach to this. You know, we are a product of our environment in which we were raised to some strong extent. And I remember sitting around the dinner table, and we would go from talking about Cubs baseball to Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, and then all the huge gamut of everything mundane to profound in between. And so I think that a large part of my approach is I was crafted as a child to have critical free thought on all issues, and and so therefore I had a role model, my father being a minister, devoted his life to Christianity and the expression of it, but at the same time being very willing to openly question comfortably live with uncertainty, and I see that's been that is the crucial thing. So I'm very thankful I had that chance to have that that context to be brought up, and I don't know how I would feel if I hadn't had that.
In our last century, science and technology has been used to bring people together, to work for greater health, to work for peace, but it's also been, science and technology have also been used to wage war much more efficiently, and many more people have died as a result of inventions from scientific and engineering minds. How do you, as a person of faith, look ahead at the dangers for science as well as its opportunities?
Well, I think the danger is to do what the current administration is doing in regard to stem cells, is to try to control and kind of deny the positive potentials that can come out of these things. There's, you know, the progress of science and technology. It's an immense force in our beings as human beings, and because it's a creative expression, and it really shapes our environment around us once we develop it. And so, I see it that these weapons of mass destruction. Yes, they were used in a very destructive way, horrible way in many regards. But on the other hand, the good that's come out of it and the need to have those things developed is essential. And it's a matter of having the tools, nurturing their development and then making sure they're used wisely. But it's not a force we're going to stop.
So you're not in favor of what the current administration is doing in terms of stopping research on stem cells, because you see some great good that can come from that.
Absolutely.
But what kind of checks and balances need there be on, say, developing biological, chemical weapons, nuclear weapons, the spread of nuclear weapons?
Well, again, you know, all these things come with a huge responsibility, and the great advancements require great responsibility in how they're applied and how they're distributed. So, unfortunately, there's no easy fix. It's not like, you know, the only thing worse than having a new technology develop and then doing your best to apply it well and then making sure to the best of your ability that it's distributed fairly and non-destructively, the only thing worse than that is to try to suppress it and hold it, because that means that there will be a small subsector somewhere that is doing this regardless. It's kind of like prohibition. And that I see that kind of immense power being in the hands of just a few is much more dangerous than having it be a powerful tool or advancement which is collectively acknowledged, applied, and then, you know, controlled in that way.
And in governments that are open and where science is open and where there's the publication of knowledge and people can check on your data and how you did things, there's that openness. But isn't it pretty easy nowadays to come up with chemical and biological and even nuclear weapons off in some hidden place, in some country where we don't care what anybody else wants us to do, we're going to do this on our own?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, the threat's much bigger in terms of the biological aspects, because a lot of this is off the shelf nowadays. But, you know, the threat's always there. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, to take a leading role, to take the stands that are necessary to show vision and positive use of all this array of tools, of technology, that's the role that we need to have as the United States. And whenever we adopted a reactionary mode where we started to step back, become protectionary and squelch kind of the free flow of some of these approaches, I think that's where the real danger lies. Mm-hmm. And, again, I see this very consistently across the board.
Where do you see, and again, another huge question, but where do you see in your fields some great leaps forward being possible in the next decades?
Oh, well, this whole idea of looking at how the environment interacts with an organism to actually control and guide the ability of that organism to live, i.e., in other words, the activities of specific genes that we have in our genetic makeup, and whether or not those genes are operating under certain environmental conditions, and seeing how these environmental conditions have changed through time so we can make predictions about the future. I think that will completely revolutionize. It'll give us an understanding of causative effects of specific environmental changes and how those have feedback with some of the original genetic hardware that was there and then how the new genetic hardware gets made. So we're going to have completely new understandings about, you know, one example is what's the relative role of some of the dissolved polymers that are in milk containers? What's that relative role on the developmental progression of young boys and girls? And we'll be able to look at, you know, what are the environmental parameters in terms of chemistry of milk and water and human body and tissue, and see what kind of genes are being expressed under what conditions. And we'll be able to apply that on a huge scale. Look at interactions of the atmosphere and the oceans on a gigantic global scale. So, I mean, the time and space frameworks will be able to be bridged in a way that will be absolutely remarkable. And that will completely change our understanding of how the mechanics of this planet work.
Hmm. So. Many of the students active at the university, YMCA, where I'm the director, are very much concerned with the environment. We have numerous student groups, Students for Environmental Concerns, Rainforest Action Group, students concerned with saving natural prairies in this area. We have many students who are just religiously committed to trying to save the environment from the misuse of government folks and some scientists with the help of some scientists and so on. What are some of the things in terms of dangers to the environment that concern you as a religious person as well as a scientist? There obviously is global warming.
Oh, absolutely.
In spite of what Rush Limbaugh says.
Right. No, absolutely. Well, again, my approach, I feel the same fervency, the same emotional fire behind my want to be a good steward for this planet and also make the planet and its wonderful resources something that not only we have, but even more importantly, something that's given to our children and their children and their children. Because right now, we're on a pathway to we're like locusts. We're just destroying everything, consuming everything, and we're going to leave a waste of mess that's going to take a long time to get fixed. And so some of the specifics are things like global warming. You know, it'd be so easy right now if we had an administration that would just step up and say, okay, we see that the use of fossil fuels is very short-lived, that we can't rely solely on that for our transportation or other things. Mm-hmm. So let's get proactive. Let's make an integrative approach to energy resources. Let's make sure every household can access solar, wind, fossil fuel, and that every household has the knowledge base and technology to plug into whichever one of those is appropriate for that sunny day in the middle of January or that wet, rainy, warm day in the middle of July or whatever it is, you know, and we have the ability, we could step up and be the forefront. Instead, what we're doing is we're putting all our chips onto this this known dead end, which mm-hmm. is fossil fuels, mm-hmm. and then all the negative ramifications of that in terms of environmental change. So
we're looking at taking the University YMCA building, which was built in 1937, and trying to update it in a green, a nature-friendly way. And, of course, it's going to cost a lot of money to do that. It's mm-hmm. expensive mm-hmm. to do the, you know, geothermal heating mm-hmm. and things like that and solar heating and cooling. And, you know, we're facing that huge challenge of how to be responsible citizens. Some of our students are motivated by religious mm-hmm. background, others just by maybe agnostic or atheist, mm-hmm. but still are very mm-hmm. much committed to the environment. But it's a huge problem.
Well, you know, my example of that is look at digital cameras. Mm-hmm. Look at how far we've come in 5 years of having that targeted as something that mm-hmm. was really attractive and needed, and then putting infinite almost resources into developing
to do it.
The quantum leaps of digital technology for making photographs is just incredible, and I think that's a good example of how green industry could operate here. If we targeted this need for multi-use energy sources and said that is something that needs to be developed, then in a very short amount of time, you know, the industries would rise and the cost of these things would be reduced to a level that, because now, you know, you can buy a digital camera for tens of dollars, literally, and still get a good digital image. And that same image 10 years ago would have cost you thousands of dollars. So.
Well, that's a wonderful image a hopeful image to end our conversation with. We've been talking on Keeping the Faith today about creation and evolution, partly as a part of the Whirlwind Project. It's focusing on creation this spring. And our Professor Bruce Fouk has been our guest. His last name is spelled Fouke, and we're delighted that he's spent this hour with us. I apologize again to listeners that we've not been able to take questions and comments, because this was a very provocative talk, and I'm sorry others couldn't have joined in. But perhaps it'll start some conversations around coffee tables around this university and farther away. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your host for this program. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Meat and potatoes isn't just what's for dinner, it's a way of life. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge, Food That Sticks to Your Ribs. We'll get into the science of the French fry and celebrate the anniversary of the hamburger. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. WILO programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
An excessive heat warning is in effect until 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly clear with the low in the mid-70s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. The heat index around 110 this evening. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the upper 90s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. The heat index around 110 in the afternoon. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-70s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. The heat index again around 110.